Why are businesses like HelloVet choosing Apple products and services?
So we started the business 2 years ago. We had a few people who were used to PCs, and this was their first foray into Macs. But it's been super smooth getting everyone onto those devices, and everyone seems really, really happy.
Find out how Mac can help you run and grow your business at apple.co/HelloVet.
I have to tell you, it really called to me. And I've talked to cave divers around the world, and they kind of describe the same experience. It calls to you. I needed and wanted to be more in that environment. I don't know why. I mean, it's a bunch of wet rocks at the end of the day, and that's all it is. But it just called to me. It's just an incredible, incredible environment, and it doesn't make any logical sense. I talk to my skydiving friends, and I think it's crazy to jump off of a perfectly good building or a perfectly good airplane, and they think I'm crazy for, you know, going underwater in a cave.
Hey, welcome to How Success Happens. I'm Dan Bova, writer and editor at entrepreneur.com. So, you know, a lot of guests come on the show and talk about getting comfortable with being uncomfortable. But today's guest brings that to a whole new level, an incredibly claustrophobic one, I might add. Jeremiah Gardner is an innovation expert who speaks with leaders at companies like GE and Nike and Unilever about transforming discomfort into bold performance. And he knows about this intimately because he is one of the few qualified underwater cave explorers in the world. So, good Lord, I don't know what that means, but it sounds terrifying. Welcome, Jeremiah.
Hey, Dan, great to be here. And yeah, I can't wait to talk about underwater exploration and, yes, and where those things match up into business.
Yeah, absolutely. We connected because I met your awesome and lovely wife, Jessie, at Entrepreneurs Level Up event, and she's shown me these videos of you like squeezing into these. I was having a panic attack watching these videos. So before we get into the business of it all, let's get into like the cave diving of it all. Like, talk to me a little bit about it. How did you get into it? And tell people who think they know what it is, what it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I love to share this world with people. And I have to say, you know, I got into diving as a hobby, and really it became my kind of environment for my relaxation and all those sorts of things. And I remember it was years ago, I happened to be in Mexico and I was just exploring different types of diving and found myself in a cenote, diving through a little, I wouldn't call it truly an overhead environment, but a little overhead environment. And I have to tell you, it really called to me. And I've talked to cave divers around the world, and they kind of describe the same experience. It calls to you. I needed and wanted to be more in that environment. I don't know why. I mean, it's a bunch of wet rocks at the end of the day, and that's all it is. But it just called to me. And so I went on a training journey to get myself trained and qualified to actually make those types of dives. And it took about two and a half years to get to that level of being able to make my first real cave dive. And for me, you know, it's an incredible, incredible environment that very few people get to see. And what lights me up about it, I think, the most is just understanding, you know, obviously the primacy of fresh water to our lives and to our environment on top of the world, and to see where those, you know, springs originate from. And how over thousands and thousands of years they've carved these underwater cave systems, and how the water flows through that, and the amazing discoveries that we make in opening that environment up for other people to follow us. And it's just an incredible, incredible environment. And it doesn't make any logical sense. You know, I talk to my skydiving friends, and I think it's crazy to jump off of a perfectly good building or a perfectly good airplane. And and they think I'm crazy for, you know, going underwater in a cave. So it doesn't make logical sense. I can't explain it. It's not an adrenaline rush thing. It's that environment just calls and sings to me almost like a siren song. And so I've done everything I can in my life to go and explore those environments at a very deep level.
So what do you see? What are we looking at when we start to get deeper into these caves?
Yeah. So what's incredible is you start to see how the water has cut through the limestone, and there's all different kinds of experiences there. You can go through everything like I'm sure you've seen, you know, squeezing through a tight restriction to rooms that you could fit, you know, 20 semi trucks in, up and down, all around, stacked on top of each other. And so there's all different kinds of formations from, you know, in the caves in Florida here in the US, you know, there's a lot of big boulders and breakdowns and things like that. And chamber to chamber, room to room, you may have differences. You know, you have some that have rolling hills of silt, some that are completely flat, sandy bottom, to where you look in Mexico and you call these more of a drip cave, where you can see the stalagmites and stalactites and columns that have formed over years. And in fact, you know, the Mayans believed that they were, the cenotes were portals to the other world. So they threw sacred things into the waters there, and divers have discovered those things, everything from bones to, you know, cultural artifacts and things like that. In Florida, it was all seabed. And so you're looking at sea urchin, you know, remains. I mean, they're not remains, they're fossilized in the sides of rocks. And you imagine, wow, where I'm, you know, so far from the sea, yet this was seabed at some time. So there's all kinds of amazing discoveries and things that are in these. But at the end of the day, Dan, it's just wet rocks. That's all it really is. And darkness if you don't have a light.
Right. So, I mean, it sounds amazing. It sounds panic inducing. Well, we could start to get into, you know, where this, you know, unique hobby, I don't know if hobby seems too light of a word, but this pursuit of yours, how it has bridged into helping business leaders navigate through what often feels like a dark, wet cave of business. And you have this, developed this thing called a Gold Line Framework. Can you explain what that is? And then we could get into, you know, how people can apply it to their businesses.
Absolutely. So, you know, a little bit more about me. I really was cut my teeth in the startup world before all the cave diving and all of those sorts of things. And so I kind of experienced everything from, you know, my middling success to complete failure that was my fault. And out of those experiences really came a book. I wrote a book called The Lean Brand back in the day with a guy named Brant Cooper. And that led to speaking and teaching and helping some of the organizations that you mentioned, things like, you know, companies like Nike and ING, GE, so on and so forth, develop their innovation programs. And so I've been the architect or a primary architect behind a lot of those programs that have produced, you know, faster velocity, customer-based true innovation. And innovation not meaning, you know, something new and fancy for new and fancy sake, but truly creating new value in the customer's eyes. And how do we, you know, practice empathy? How do we practice experimentation? How do we make decisions based on evidence? And so that was kind of my career leading up. And I always felt like there were these two worlds. There was this diving recreational world and caves, and there was the innovation growth world, kind of solving uncertainty. And it dawned on me a few years ago on an expedition I was leading in Florida, actually, that as I'm swimming along, there is this line. One of the major rules we have in cave diving is that we have a continuous physical line back to where we came from. Because if something goes wrong, we can't go up anymore. We have to go back out the way we came. So no matter where we're exploring, if we're going down this side chamber, or we want to see where this particular passage goes, we always have a physical line as a reference point that we've either laid or that you know, local divers have laid. And we call that line the gold line.
Do you know what you want for Christmas?
A cute toy.
No, I just want my family back.
That's what I want for Christmas.
We'll see what Santa can do, okay?
It's Christmas, so be of good cheer.
Merry Christmas.
'Tis the season to watch telly on Channel 4. Stream now.
And it's just referred to as that. And sometimes it is gold. It's a yellow line. Sometimes it's not. It depends on the system. It depends on who put that line in there. But metaphorically, we call it the gold line. And it dawned on me in a moment in that exploration that, wow, you know, this line is both a safety, a comfort, in the sense that I know I can get out, but it also pushes me forward. Because I know I can get out, that safety net exists, it pushes me to go explore that chamber or that passage or that area that I don't really know what's in there. I don't know exactly how to get out of there without that line. And it kind of snapped underwater that, oh my gosh, my whole life, these two things are the same disciplines. Whether it be innovation and startup and business growth, or it be cave diving, they're the same discipline. It's exploring and embracing uncertainty for the sake of discovery. And that's where the gold line really came out of, was that, wow, I can combine these two parts of my life that are really important to me. And they're the same discipline, just different applications.
I love that. And as you're talking about this line, of course, I'm in my head going, what if the line breaks? What if somebody snips it? You know?
Exactly. Exactly true.
So I wonder, you know, when you talk about innovation, it's such a big, all-encompassing word. Can we get a little granular with that? Like, can you give an example of gold, how a gold line can lead to innovation, but like in very specific terms? You know, maybe it's someone specifically that you helped, or someone who's listening to this could use it. Say my sales aren't where I want them to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I say the word innovation, I mean something specific. And I think you're right. It's a big umbrella word. You know, we pack a lot of different things in it. And oftentimes, you know, if you ask people or entrepreneurs, what's the you know, picture you have in your head of innovation? What's the symbol you would come up with? They come up with, you know, the light bulb almost always, right? And they say, okay, who invented the light bulb? Oh, Thomas Edison, of course. Well, so what was it, the idea of the light bulb that popped in his head, and now, you know, we have light and it's changed, you know, our culture into a nighttime culture and everything else. And when you dig into the story, the real story is not that he had the idea for the light bulb. He actually had a ton of people in his lab working on making it safe to bring inside, the filament that's in there. And so to me, the work of innovation is not the work of ideas, which sometimes we call innovation. It's also not the work of invention, which can be something that new technology or something like that. Innovation is the work of creating new value. And that value means not value to us as a business, but value in the eyes of the customer. And of course, we need to be able to capture that back as a business. That's the transaction that occurs. But the discovery, delivery, and development of new value in the customer's eyes is truly innovation. And when you think about that, you know, the answer is that everybody in the organization has a customer. If I sit within HR, who is my customer? Well, it's a diverse group. Yes, it's the employees, but are we talking about, you know, the new onboarding employees? Or are we talking about people that have been there for 20 years? Are we talking about new managers? Are we, who's the specific segment we're serving? If we're talking about sales, we're talking about a different set of clients than necessarily who the users would be of what we sell. And so defining who the customer is the first step in truly creating innovation. And that means being specific. I call it being uncomfortably narrow in our ability to define the customer. Most people, when they think about, let's say sales are low, or we have this new product we want to bring to market, if we think about a bell curve of adoption that almost every new product and technology goes through, when we're thinking about it, we think about hitting the middle of that bell curve, the center of it. And the reality is no product has ever started that way. They all start with an early adopter segment or an innovator segment. And we have to be uncomfortably narrow in that growth back to that segment, right? Mm. Back to the, who we're going to start with first. And it kind of goes back to the old adage of, you know, I need 100 customers. And you ask the entrepreneur, how many do you have now? And they say, well, zero. So, no, you need one customer. Then if you can do that, you can get to two. Yeah. And then two to four. So I think the first discipline is really defining in an uncomfortable way, in a narrow way, who are we serving and what is the pain point that we're actually addressing. That is where we start to see true innovation or growth, or in my words, the search side of the house start to create value for the business.
So when you say uncomfortably narrow, does that, you know, is it that I'm not trying to find all kinds of different people who are going to love this thing? It's a very specific person. Is that what you mean by uncomfortable?
Yeah. So let's take a backwards track into Facebook. And it's a good example in some ways of this adoption curve. And if we think, I'm old enough, and so I guess I'm dating myself now, but I'm old enough to remember, I don't know about you, Dan, probably not, but when Facebook was just for Harvard, right? Harvard.edu, you had to be there. And then it started to open up to the Ivy Leagues. And then eventually I was still in college when I remember my university got access to Facebook. So if you had a .edu TLD to your email address, you could get on Facebook. And I remember it being the coolest thing, like, oh my gosh, all my friends, and oh, there's some people that, you know, are next door in the dorm. And then it opened up a little bit more where your high school friends were on there, and it started to go up that curve a little bit. And then at some point, I don't remember what year it was, but like your mom got on Facebook and you're like, no, no, I can't believe it. You know, it just, and you could see that's the top of that, the top of the bell curve now, you know, and now all of a sudden it's not cool anymore. Right.
Right.
And now you have these laggards on the back end of it where now, you know, grandma and grandpa are on it and, you know, posting political memes all day long. And that's what it is now. Right? So if you think of that adoption curve, who's the narrow segment? Well, it was Harvard, and it was actually a personal problem, right? Uber was the same way. It was black car executives only in San Francisco. And if you retrace the steps of what we see as successful startups or successful businesses. I mean, Amazon was a bookseller in Seattle. That was it. You could buy books. And so being uncomfortably narrow is not about the fact that your vision is small. It's about deciding where to start. And that's where the pain is greatest. And whenever we're creating something new, wherever we're exploring uncertainty in that way, being more narrow gives us a stronger ability to separate signal from noise and grow from there.
So when we talk about the gold line as this kind of safety device, can you give, like, how does that work with business? It's you're not going too far in one direction that you abandon something that was working. Like, can you define that a little bit?
Absolutely. I think there's kind of two paths to this. There's a personal gold line that exists, I think, for all of us. And it roots us in where we make our highest contribution and allows us to explore ways to express that. On the business side of that, we have a shared gold line, right? That we as a business, as a team, as a company are having. And to me, that center line, the thing that keeps us safe in that exploration, is centering on the empathy that we have and that only we own for our customers. It's understanding deeply the pain that they're experiencing. It's understanding deeply the relationship that they have with us. And when we put that at the center of that exploration and we start to go down a path that maybe we haven't explored before, that deep understanding of who we're serving and what the needs are there and where the jobs that they're trying to achieve are and the aspirations exist, keep us safe in that exploration because it keeps us from building something nobody wants. It keeps us from building something that ultimately will not be successful because it doesn't solve a pain. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in, I think, the startup world about vitamins versus painkillers. And I think this is true, that if we want to have success, we need to be a painkiller, not a nice-to-have vitamin. And, you know, when we discover that pain point is our center point that keeps us rooted in really delivering value back to the customer.
Yeah, that's great. I'm curious about a parallel between, so when you're cave diving and you're in an area that you haven't been before, you know, I guess there's a risk reward of going through, I don't know what you'd even call it, some opening to see what's on the other side. But who knows what's on the other side, and who knows if you'll be able to turn around. I don't know what the exact risks are. But what are the parallels between that kind of risk taking, the risk reward there, and the risk reward with business leaders that you talk to?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think this kind of hits on the methodology a little bit that I've developed around the Gold Line. You know, the first thing that we have to do if we're exploring something new is we actually have to trace that line, right? We have to understand, you know, where there's no map, where, you know, there's no guarantees. You know, we have to be able to trace where we've been. And so looking backwards often is a place for us to really mine out the value that we've created in the past, if we're existing in a business, or to understand if we're starting something brand new, what the value that the customer has been chasing. If it's painful enough, they're trying to solve it today. And so that first step of tracing the line, finding where we've made our greatest contribution, that's based in the evidence of the past, not necessarily the goodwill of the future, is really the first step. And I think that that's where sometimes we get it wrong. We want to be something, but we don't have any evidence that supports that's actually what a customer wants, or where we can even be successful as a business. And it could be very disastrous, you know. And so that first step is tracing that line, really understanding where it is. And the second step then becomes the hard and tedious work of anchoring it to something real. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean that you have to be able to build the infrastructure to support that line. If we're in a cave and we're exploring and we tie the Gold Line to a flimsy tie down or a rock that might move, that's not actually solid, when we come back, you can imagine how scary that could be when the line is just floating in the air. We have no idea where it's going anymore, you know. And so there has to be real things that we anchor it to. You know, for me, I love speaking, and that's where I'm building out and teaching and workshops, and I'm building out my Gold Line really exists there. But that means I have to do the hard work of building the outreach engine. I have to do the hard work of the spreadsheets and building the relationships. I have to do the hard work of literally building the stage that I want to stand on. It's not fun. It's the tedious hard work of anchoring the line into something real. And if it's not anchored, then we can't trust it. And so the same thing becomes true for business. What are the things that we need to be doing today that we're not anchored in, you know, that we don't have the line tied tight to? What are the gaps of our understanding of our customer and the pain points that they might have that we need to really solidify for ourselves to be able to explore?
Well, I was just about to ask, in the people that you've spoken with and worked with, you know, are there any examples of maybe someone who they just really wanted something to work and it wasn't working? And was there a moment where you were able to kind of open their eyes to that fact, and then they were able to pivot and then things worked out for them? Like, have you experienced that?
Yeah, there's some great examples. I've experienced the same thing. You know, my first startup was failed literally because of me, and I had no idea at the time. But you know, I'll give an example of a recent company I've been working with. You know, they have a legacy product or a core product that's very, very successful, and they need to diversify the portfolio, right, to continue to grow. That growth comes from diversification. And so they were really taking an approach around how do we invest in a few pipeline innovation products that we can continue to add to the core to grow and diversify the business. And, you know, what they were doing was they were building product first, and all the features they could have heard, and they were asking, you know, grandma and friends, would they use it and do they like it and all these things. And once they had the product built, then they turned around and said, well, you know, who's the customer for this and what's the need? And found out after millions and millions of dollars and years and years and years that approach was sinking all of the work. Nothing was being successful. And so I got involved and in their diversification side, and said, okay, well, what if we look at this a little bit differently? What if we, instead of taking a pipeline view where we have a few small investments in or a few large investments in a small amount of projects, why don't we look at this more as an exploration project and say, why don't we make small bets in lots of different areas and then measure the evidence as we go through to really understand what we have versus what we don't? And so that became a process of starting with the riskiest areas first. Well, the riskiest thing to any business is there a customer and is there a need? If those things we don't have evidence for, there's no point in talking about the brand. There's no point in talking about, you know, the solution, what it will look like, or the value proposition. If there's no need and there's no customer, we don't pass go. So we should shut it down there, right? But if we can say there's a customer and there's a need, all right, great. What's the next tranche of risk that we need to deal with? Well, what's the value proposition that would address that? What are the requirements of a solution? Could we actually build that? And what's the competitive advantage that might exist for us out in the market in doing this? All right, let's generate some evidence on that. Let's see if we can get that. If we can't, let's stop. If we can, let's deal with the next tranche. And the next tranche is really saying, can we deliver it through channels? Can we measure it? And what would success look like? What's the cost to launch and maintain? And what's the business capture from it? And when we deal with all that risk, I would call that tier three risk at this point. Now we have something we can take to the market, to that first early adopter market, and really test, right? And so what you deal with risk, instead of dealing with it from, you know, the broad perspective of everything at all at once, we break it down into where the riskiest portions are and progressively deal with that risk over time. And taking that approach with this organization, which has resulted in what I would call a portfolio view of innovation rather than a pipeline view of innovation, has transformed them in a way that they are able to pursue lots of different, what they would call spokes, to that centralized hub of their core business that's working today.
That's amazing. And I, you know, the show's called How Success Happens. So for you in your work, you know, success, obviously, I think there's one obvious outcome where we're selling more, we're making more money, we're making more revenue. But, you know, it sounds like success is also, you know, testing something out and realizing this isn't going to work before we spend too much time and energy on it.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. And this is the hardest conversation to have. But I always talk about with innovation leaders, if you can't talk to the CFO about innovation, you're sunk. And so discovering, it's not about failing fast. I actually hate that phrase, Dan. And I have a t-shirt that crosses out fail and it replaces it with learn. It's about learning fast, right? And it's not about failing fast.
Yeah.
But failure is part of learning. Learning what doesn't work is as valuable to us as learning what does work, because we stop wasting time. We stop wasting resources. You know, I've worked with lots of teams that have spent lots of time and money on something that didn't work, and that felt terrible. And they always say something, and I'm sure you've heard this before, if I had only known now what, right, I know now, or yeah, what then what I know now. And to me, that's saying, if I had only paused and identified all the assumptions first as I was going.
Yeah.
Because so much is built on assumptions. And once we identify those assumptions, we're able to run experiments against them and generate evidence against it. And that leads us to truly knowing which direction you want to go and which direction you don't want to go, or is not going to be tenable. And so to me, it's, you know, innovation inside of a large organization or inside of a smaller organization really is more of a cost-saving center of not pursuing things that don't have needs, that don't have customers, that can't deliver on a value proposition, than it is a revenue center, in the sense that none of us can guarantee that whatever we're pursuing is going to work, is going to produce that $1 million or that $1 billion. And so when we look more at learning as quickly as we can what doesn't work, it focuses our resources on the areas that we have evidence to drive us that is working. And it allows us to really increase the velocity and speed at which we can bring those things to market and ultimately capture the value from them.
I love that. That's fantastic. And before, you know, before we get too much further, I wanted to, you know, let people know how they could learn more from you about your website, your book, and you know, to get more information on this.
Yeah, I think you know, the biggest thing is you can go to jeremiahgardner.com/getclarity. And if you're thinking about you know, where you are in your personal gold line along that tracing where you make your impact, you know, anchoring that into to true lines or true places, and then navigating that line, there's a really cool free snapshot you can take that'll give you, hey, here's where you are personally in this. You can also check out the website in terms of bringing me into your organization and helping you think through some of the biggest challenges that you've got, some of the things that you're dealing with uncertainty. But I think the biggest thing that I would say to everybody, whether you get in touch with me or you don't, is that, you know, the discipline of searching, the discipline of dealing with uncertainty, I think is no longer novel. I think at some point it was. But now the world is full of uncertainty. I mean, global markets and all sorts of different things. And, you know, you raise the hand and say, you know, 5 years ago, you ask everybody in the room, how many of you today use Twitter? Almost every hand goes up. Today, you ask that question and there's a couple hands. And then you say, how many of you used ChatGPT today? And almost every hand goes up.
Right.
And I mean, that's a 5-year span of crazy uncertainty.
Yeah.
And so embracing that uncertainty in a disciplined and repeatable manner, whatever that means to you and your business, is I think the new reality rather than the novel reality anymore. And I would encourage you to take that dive. To, you know, you don't have to be a cave diver squeezing through restrictions to get the same insights. But uncertainty is not something to sweep under the carpet anymore. It's something to bring out early and often and make it visible, so that you can deal with it in a very structured way.
Awesome. Awesome. I was definitely going to check that out. So let's move into the celebrated speed round of this show. So we're going to ask you a couple of quick questions and, you know, whatever comes to mind. So first one, what is a habit that you are happy to have and one that you wish you could ditch?
Happy to have. I'm glad that I take time in my own meditation. That practice has been really important to me in just slowing things down. Bad habit to have is I replaced coffee with Monsters, and I'm trying to replace Monsters with water and or liquid IV, and it's not happening yet. So one Monster a day is where I'm limited now, and I'm trying to get off that bad habit.
Okay. Good luck with that. So, all right. Underwater cave diving. So a lot of people are afraid of confined spaces. People are afraid of the dark. So people are afraid of water. So I'm wondering, what are you afraid of? You have any phobias?
Oh, I hate reptiles. It okay. sounds so silly. But you can't anticipate what they're going to do. And so I went to an alligator farm actually not too long ago in the Florida Keys while I was visiting. And that's just like a farm of terror to me, seeing all these alligators and things around. And it's funny because there's actually all throughout Florida signs where the caves are that you know, alligators may be present. And they're nice signs. I'll have to send you a picture, Dan. But it says, you know, usually they eat small things like fish or chickens, but they've been known to attack larger things and attack humans, .. So be careful. So it terrifies me. I've yet to see one in a cave, but oh my God, that's a nightmare of mine, that seeing an alligator in the headwaters of a cave would just scare the bejeebers out of me.
What is this? What's the scariest thing you've actually seen?
Scariest thing I've actually seen in a cave?
Yeah.
My instructor.
Okay.
Coming with some new failure that I've got to work through during training.
Great. And then finally, as someone who has mastered the underwater domain, who do you relate most to, Aquaman or SpongeBob?
Ooh, that is a good question. I got to say SpongeBob. You know, and what's pointing me that direction is an episode of Family Guy back in the day where Aquaman, like, you know, there's a crime taking place on the shore and he's like, pops up, hey, stop it. Stop doing that. I'm going to send some fish your way. Like, he's just helpless as a superhero. So I think, you know, he's a little disillusioned as a superhero. And I think SpongeBob is who SpongeBob is. And he's okay with that. And I hope I am who I am, no matter what room I'm in.
That's awesome. That's great. I love that. All right, man. Well, so great talking to you. And again, you want to let people know where they could follow you and see all things Jeremiah Gardner?
Yeah, jeremiahgardner.com. You can find me on Insta as well. But yeah, reach out. And I'll give you my email address directly, j@jeremiahgardner.com. Feel free to send me an email. I'd love to hear your stories of uncertainty. I'd love to share some cave diving pictures if you'd like to see them. And just get to know those that are out there embracing uncertainty. I think it's an amazing community that continues to emerge around the work that I get to do. And so if you're interested in joining that, would love to have you as part of it.
Awesome. Great, man.